Well, we've all watched some scary movies, haven't we? I mean, really scary movies. In a moment, Robert Bartholomew joins us. We'll be talking about his latest work, American Hauntings, True Stories Behind Hollywood's Scariest Movies, From The Exorcist to The Conjuring. Stand by on Coast to Coast AM. Well, let me tell you a little bit about our guest, Robert Bartholomew. Dr. Robert Bartholomew is a medical sociologist. He has written extensively on cryptozoology, poltergeists, social panics, mass hysterias, UFOs, the history of tabloid journalism. He's known for working with both believers and skeptics and sees his role as simply laying out the evidence both for and against and letting people decide on their own. He is considered a sympathetic skeptic. He requires conclusive proof of extraordinary claims beyond blurry photos and other kinds of testimony. Yet he admits that there's a small number of cases that science can't explain. And here he is on Coast to Coast. Good to have you back, Robert. How are you?
Great, George. Thank you.
Super. I was at a seance about a week or so ago, and my jury is still out on this one. It was well done. It was an incredible performance, but they checked us all out for apparatuses and, you know, whether we had little flashlights on us. They put a metal detector around us. We had to hold hands, which means that we couldn't get up from our chair. We were in total darkness, Robert, total darkness, couldn't see anything. And all these little disembodied spirits would come out, but they had a physical part of them. They came up to you in the dark. You couldn't see anything. They put their hand on your head. They talk. I don't know. I wish I had a flashlight. I would have turned it on. What do you think?
Well, I'd love to have been there. You know, as a scientist, it's very difficult sometimes to keep an open mind on these things, but you really have to, because I had a really unusual experience back in 1994 when I was in Malaysia. It was in October, and I'd walked into our house alone. It was broad daylight, and I set some groceries on the living room table, including a 4-liter jug of orange juice. It was in a plastic container with a very large diameter, about 6 inches on the bottom. And I went into the kitchen for just a second, and I heard this thud, and I looked back, and this container was over on its side. I could have taken that container, put it on the ground, and hit it with a bowling ball, and it wouldn't have fallen over. And to this day, I cannot explain what happened that afternoon in Malaysia. I just don't know. There are some things we can't explain.
No, you're right about that. There are many things we can't explain. And I think being a skeptic is healthy, as long as they have that open mind that if, you know, somebody can prove something, and sometimes you can prove things without hard evidence, but it's soft evidence, as I call it. They should have an open mind to these things. And you know, you're what they're called a sympathetic skeptic. You've got that open mind. I think that's important.
Yeah, you know, on the one hand, there's a massive accumulation of evidence for ghosts that date back centuries. There's been thousands and thousands of reports by credible people reporting incredible experiences. So there are ghosts. Just like there are UFOs, the question is, what are they? Are they something from our subconscious, or are they some kind of psychic phenomena that's being projected by people, particularly poltergeist phenomena by young, angry people, or is it proof of life after death? I simply don't know, and I see my job as presenting the evidence both for and against. And one thing about this book, American Hauntings, it's a book that people can rely on. There's a lot of books out there, and you read them on ghosts, and most aren't very scientific or rigorous. And most scientists tend to be rather dismissive.
That's right.
And what I wanted to do was look at the best cases in the world that I could find, where there's a lot of testimony and evidence and so compelling that they've been made into Hollywood films and major TV shows. And so that's what we've done here. It's a book that's thoroughly documented, and you can rely on what we say. And if it's speculation, we say we're speculating.
You know, and the fact that you're a scientist, I think, adds so much more credibility to this And we need more people like you, Robert, doing this.
Well, you know, I'm biased, and I think we're all biased because I want there to be life after death. I think we all hope there's life after death, and that's one of the reasons I did this book, because I would like to find some evidence for life after death, and I've always been fascinated by haunted houses. I wanted to know if they're real, and so we picked these cases, and they're based supposedly on a true story. And so what we're doing is we're looking at the story behind the story and in what evidence is there. But really, I'm not totally objective because I really want there to be something there.
Why? How come you have to have that?
Well, because I want there to be life after death.
For yourself, for your own purposes, or
well, I would love
for the world?
When I die and everybody else dies, that we go to heaven or there's something else beyond our life here. So deep down, even though I'm a sympathetic skeptic, deep down I would hope that there is something beyond this existence that we have on this planet, and that there is a spiritual world out there. And so I have to be careful. And my motto is that old medical adage, when you hear the sound of hoofbeats in the night, first think horses, not zebras. But keeping in mind, there are zebras out there, and we have to keep an open mind.
Mm-hmm. No, there's no doubt about that. I've always wondered whether near-death experiences were some little quirk in the brain that would create this feeling of the light, the tunnel. And, you know, you would think that you were seeing your dearly departed loved ones. I've always wondered if it's just a product of the brain. What do you think?
Well, Carl Sagan said, wherever we have strong emotions, we're liable to fool ourselves. You know, I'm not smart enough to answer that. I am smart enough to collect as much information as I could on these seven famous hauntings and really do put them under the microscope and examine them very closely. The best cases supposedly out there for survival of the human spirit.
As a scientist, what got you involved in this in the first place, to this quest to try to get these answers about life after death and ghosts?
Yeah, I've always been interested in UFOs, ghosts, cryptozoology, as long as I can remember. And I enjoy doing it. I enjoy talking about it. I enjoy researching it. It's a giant jigsaw puzzle, and I can be part of trying to answer this puzzle.
When you wrote your book, Champ, about America's Loch Ness Monster, Champy, I think we're still getting stories about that creature.
Yeah, we are. The problem with Champ is there still isn't a body out there, and
right.
I require that body. Even though there's some really fascinating, very credible reports, we still have to be careful because there's the Cottingley Ferry photos that were hoaxed.
Great cutouts, weren't they?
That's right, from a book.
Yep.
The Cardiff Giant. Not only hoaxes, I mean, most people are honest people. They're credible people reporting incredible experiences, but human perception is quite fallible and subject to error, so we have to be very careful. The human mind does not take in information like a video cassette recorder. It interprets as it takes it in. All you have to do is watch an NFL football game and, you know, did he fumble? Did he not fumble? And these plays that can't be looked at again, like what happened with the Seattle Seahawks there recently. There's a referee looking right at that, and he knows the rule book, and he didn't call it.
Well, with Dr. Robert Bartholomew, we're talking about his latest work, American Hauntings. A little bit later on tonight, we're going to talk about some of these specific cases of some of these scary movies that were based on real episodes that occurred. Now, when I say real episodes, people actually believe these things had happened to them in houses and wherever they may have been. When you look at, like, the Bigfoot phenomenon, Sasquatch, do you ever get to a point where you say, so many people say that they've seen these creatures, they're not lying, I have to conclude, as a scientist, without hard evidence, that they're seeing something, I don't know what, that most of them aren't lying, a few of them probably are, but that there is some kind of creature out there. Can you conclude that without having the physical body of a Bigfoot?
I think you really have to have the physical body. The thing with science is, science deals with probabilities and not absolutes. If you were to ask me whether I think Bigfoot is real or not, people ask me that all the time. I say, well, from a probability perspective, without a body, fossil, or bones, I'm sympathetically skeptical, but it's still possible. I would never say that Bigfoot couldn't be out there. And there's a lot of really interesting reports. On the other hand, I have to have that physical evidence. I have to have the dead alien in front of me or the dead carcass of Champ.
But so you won't believe it on faith?
No, I have to have some hard evidence there because, in the past, up until maybe the 1920s and 30s, in many parts of the world, people believed in theories. And maybe they are these little spirit beings that live around with us. I don't know.
Right.
But people were reporting theories. There was the Fairy Investigation Society in England run by Leslie Shepherd up until the mid-1970s. And people would take down fairy reports. But I have to have some proof beyond eyewitness testimony because that's soft evidence. I need hard evidence as a scientist. As much as I want to believe, I still have to have that hard evidence.
Well, and in Ireland, for example, Robert, the incredible stories of leprechauns, these little people, they talk about it as if it's fact. A lot of us thought maybe this is just myth. But when you hear what they're saying, there may be some truth to that. But I don't have anybody around who's captured a little leprechaun.
That's a good point.
Your work, American Hauntings, how did you pick the various places we're going to talk about tonight?
Well, these are cases that parapsychologists have lauded as being the best cases. And, there's a lot of documentation on these cases. And if you mention the Amityville Horror, everybody's heard of the Amityville Horror, arguably the most famous haunted house in history. The Exorcist, The Conjuring, Poltergeist. These are all very famous cases. And there's a tremendous amount of documentation. And there's so much documentation that you can determine within reasonable bounds whether this actually happened or not.
Hollywood, of course, distorts some of these. They obviously need to make it look graphic and scary and everything like that. But there is a little semblance of truth, though, in those movies.
There is. And what we have done is we go back to the original case. For example, several of these films were based on the research and firsthand investigation by Ed and Lorraine Warren.
That's right.
And if you look at these cases, they're very detailed. They've written them up in books. They've given interviews, and the people involved have given interviews. So we not only look at the film itself and how it's portrayed in the film, but the actual original case on which the film was based.
All right, we're going to have some fun, and I've got some clips of these several of these movies that we'll play next half hour, Robert, to set the stage as we talk about these areas. Now, when you investigated some of these reports, did anything ever happen to you? Did you witness something bizarre?
Other than that incident in Malaysia, I live a pretty vanilla life, but the one case that stands out to me that really excited me to the point where I'd never seen a case like it before, that's the famous Don Decker case. Are you familiar with that case?
Tell me about that. Tell us all about that.
Hands down, it's the single most startling case I've ever come across. The Don Decker case is the case of the man who could make it rain. The X-Files did an episode that was very similar to this and was probably based on the case. When I first heard about this, a TV show in Canada had phoned me, and they said, you know, there's this case that we can't get any skeptics to come up and give us any plausible explanation. Do you have an explanation? So I did some research on it. And in 1983, in Strasburg, Pennsylvania, there was a young man there in his early 20s named Don Decker. And he was sitting in a house and reportedly went into a trance, and it started to rain inside the house. He was reported to have levitated off the ground twice, and he lifted up his sleeve, and there was a bleeding cross like on his arm. Now, you might think, well, that sounds kind of far-fetched. Not only did two respected couples witness this, one lived in the house, the other couple were the landlords, but four different police officers who went to the house all swore that it happened, that he was there, he was in a trance, and it was raining inside the house. They checked for leaking pipes. There was nothing.
Wow.
Unsolved Mysteries featured this a number of years ago, and also the TV show Paranormal Witness.
That was on Sci-Fi, right?
That's right. Paranormal Witness is a great show because they give these cases in the person's own words. So there's no way that you can mistranslate what they're saying. It's like they're interviewing them. This is what they said. So there's no misinterpretation at all. So the grandfather in this case, Don Decker's grandfather, had just died, and he was under a tremendous amount of stress. And so he goes into this trance, and they hear this loud cracking noise above them, and it starts to rain. And what do you do when it starts to rain like that and the guy goes into the trance? They automatically thought that it was some kind of possession. It was possessed by the devil, and the devil was causing this rain, so they called the police. I'm not sure how that conversation goes when you call the police and you think your house has been possessed.
But right. What do you tell them?
I saw this, and I'm listening to the testimony of the four police officers, and these people absolutely are not making this up. And I looked at phases of the moon. I looked at planetary alignments, solar flares, freak weather conditions. I looked at the weather archives for Strasburg, Pennsylvania for the week of February 24th, 1983. Nothing. There's just nothing out of the ordinary. And then something struck me as being very odd. 10 days before, they had the heaviest snowfall for any February storm. They had 22 inches of snow, followed by very warm days and freezing nights. And these are perfect conditions for an ice dam, which is a pocket of water forms under the ice on the roof. And when it breaks open, it makes a cracking sound, just like they reported in the house. And then the water leaks down.
Right.
And it's usually confined to one room. And this was confined to one room. But this possibility never crossed the minds of the people there because they were very religious. And the interesting thing is, the four police officers who ended up being called to the house, they were all very religious as well. And they thought it was Satan. You know, myself, I would have called some kind of roof expert
first,
but they automatically assumed it was Satan.
All right, stay with us, Robert. We're going to take this quick break, and we're going to come back. Robert is live in New Zealand. We're talking about his work, American Hauntings. We're going to get involved now in some of these stories, these scariest movies that are out there based on events that happened in real life. Now, did they really happen? We don't know, but the people involved believe they were. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest, Dr. Robert Bartholomew, we're talking about his latest work, American Hauntings. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Dr. Robert Bartholomew with us. So, Robert, let's talk about the first film, which is called The Conjuring. And, of course, this had to do with the Perrin family. They had a 10-year ordeal in their Rhode Island farmhouse. I'm not going to get to sleep, Robert.
You know, that's one of the reasons we wrote this book is, you know, I have some of my kids in my family. They can't watch some of these movies without being petrified and bothering them. And if some of these films like The Exorcist, The Conjuring bothers people, I think it helps if you know the story, the real story behind the movie. So it helps you to become less afraid.
Now, isn't this is the case that Ed and Lorraine Warren investigated?
That's right. And it's been marketed as based on true events, the story of Roger and Carolyn Perrin and their five daughters. They had moved into a supposedly haunted Rhode Island farmhouse in 1971. And over 10 years, they said they had an array of encounters with spirits. Now, we carefully looked at the books that Andrea Perrin has written, looked at her interviews, and looked at other information in this case. And after careful examination, you know, we are convinced that the family is telling the truth. But it doesn't necessarily mean it actually happened.
But they believe it happened.
That's right. I like to say that it's the family that scared themselves. Mrs. Perrin and her five daughters were living alone in this remote farmhouse, and Mr. Perrin was away as a salesman much of the time. I think in the movie he was a truck driver. And Mrs. Perrin had a great influence on the girls, and she experienced a number of things that spooked the girls. There were several psychological conditions that she was experiencing that were redefined as supernatural in origin. For example, one night she's lying in bed, and she describes seeing her dresser erupt in flames.
Jeez.
She's laying there in bed, paralyzed. She's petrified. She said she couldn't move. It was very vivid. There were sparkling lights and intense, brilliant colors. And then suddenly, she said she snapped out of it, and it was all gone. Everything was back to normal, and there had been no fire. Her description is a textbook example of a waking dream accompanied by sleep paralysis. These states usually occur in that twilight interface as people are dozing off or waking up. And in this instance, she was just falling asleep in bed.
You remember the case, the alien abduction case back in the 60s, the Betty and Barney Hill case. Look magazine really brought it to the forefront with its interrupted journey in those kinds of stories. I had an opportunity when I was 21 years old, Robert, to interview their psychologist, their psychiatrist, Dr. Benjamin Simon. He was out of New York. I got him on the phone. I'm in Detroit, and we taped it. And somewhere along the line, I've got all these tapes somewhere, and I can't find any of them. Yeah, they're in one box. But I asked him specifically exactly what you just brought up, and that was, are they telling the truth? And he said, yes, they are telling the truth. Then he said, let me qualify that. I don't know if they were abducted or not. They believe they were abducted. They believe they saw extraterrestrials. They believe they were taken aboard a craft. Separately, under hypnosis, both of them said the similar things. He said, they're not lying. They believe this, but I don't know if it's real or not, if it happened to them. And that's exactly what you just said.
That's right. The interesting thing is, to people who claim they were abducted or have seen a ghost or have seen Bigfoot, it happened. It happened to them. There's a lot of skeptics out there that make fun of people that have stories like this. Absolutely, I do not. Because most people are honest, sincere people. And who knows, maybe some of this phenomena is real. But there's another instance in The Conjuring where, in another case, she was waking up from sleep, Mrs. Perrin. And she said she opened her eyes and she saw a grotesque-looking woman hovering above her. She was paralyzed,
mm-hmm.
images. And she said it was on top of her. And psychologists have referred to this as the old hag phenomenon. David Herford wrote a book a number of years ago called The Terror That Comes in the Night. Throughout history, people have reported waking up in the night. They can't move, and they feel suffocating, and there's an evil creature on their chest. In the Middle Ages, they called it the incubus and the succubus. The incubus was a male demon believed to have sexual intercourse with a sleeping woman, and then the succubus just the opposite. And so if you start looking at these stories, again, I think it's the family that scared themselves. They're honest, sincere people. And, of course, she is the the key person because she's the mother, and they're alone in the farmhouse with five young girls who can, you know, that's a very suggestive, powerful position to be in.
And you're right about this old hag syndrome, where a lot of people may be experiencing absolute sleep paralysis, a medical condition, yet they feel as if this old hag is there holding them down. And many people say that when the children have had that experience, when they get older, they've always had a sickly life. Something has happened to them. Their strength, their energy has been zapped from them. It's bizarre. But in this case, you believe they told the truth, but you don't know what happened.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's the case of April, the young girl, and she had this imaginary playmate, Oliver. Well, imaginary companions, it used to be seen as something odd or abnormal. Now it's well known imaginary companions are a sign of mental health. There was a recent study of 1,800 children that found children between the ages of 5 and 12, nearly half, had invisible playmates as children. And it's usually when they're isolated, and here they're in an isolated farmhouse.
That's right.
And she's alone a lot of the time. So you create these imaginary playmates. My kids, when we were living in the outback of Central Australia teaching Aborigines, we were quite isolated. They had this really elaborate, complex thing going on with stuffed animals. And it's a natural part of the human spirit to do something like this. You need to be creative.
But you cannot say, and I'm not hearing you say that whatever happened to them was definitely not a paranormal ghostly experience. You can't say that, can you?
No, I can say, I think in all probability, it's the family that scared themselves, but who am I to say, because it's a deeply personal experience that they had. It's important to understand the mindset of the family, though. In 2012, the parents' sisters visited the set of The Conjuring out in California, and a gust of wind came up and blew parts of the set over. And their immediate conclusion was it was an evil spirit from the house.
Right, following them.
Yeah, so to me this is very telling, because it shows just how easily they were prone to redefining mundane events in a supernatural light.
Now, our next one, of course, is The Exorcist. It's based on a 1949 case where a group of priests at a hospital in St. Louis, Election Brothers Hospital, tried to exorcise a young boy from Baltimore over many weeks. You got to admit there, Robert, it was a great movie, right?
I'm frightened just listening to that.
I know, me too. There's a lot of people who aren't going to get to sleep tonight. I'm sorry, folks, but that's what the show is tonight, and we've got more later. But great movie, absolutely great movie. Put Linda Blair on the map. It had elements in there that were amazing. I tried for years to interview the last surviving priest of the real exorcism. He just didn't want to talk anymore. Now he's dead. But tell me about this case.
Well, and I believe you're originally from St. Louis, aren't you?
Yeah. Born in Detroit, but I spent time in St. Louis and go back and forth now.
Well, the film was released in 1973, and it depicted the demonic possession of this young girl, which was played by Linda Blair. In real life, it was a 14-year-old boy. It's a very powerful film. You may recall this. When the film came out, and there are many medical journals that have written on this, a number of people, similar to The Passion of the Christ, when that came out, had psychiatric breakdowns in the theater. Can you recall that happening?
Yes, I sure do. They had epiphanies.
That's right. And I've looked at the medical journals in these cases, and it looks like the formula is devout Christian, pre-existing psychiatric condition, someone who's recently lost a loved one, and the tremendous stress of seeing the film is what triggered these psychotic episodes. Now, there's probably at least a dozen that have been documented. But The Exorcist, as you were saying, it's inspired by the real-life diary of Father Bishop, who was he documented this exorcism of this boy in St. Louis, Missouri in 1949. It took about 25 sessions to cure the boy and to stop him from being possessed. In reality, the boy was nicknamed Robbie. That's what they referred to him in the diary. And he was from Cottage City, Maryland.
And he's alive now. He's out there somewhere, isn't he?
That's right. And there seemed to be a poltergeist phenomenon associated with him. Furniture would move, objects would fly through the air. So it's a poltergeist case as well.
Right.
And he communicated, very interesting case, he communicated by scratches on his body, bloody scratches. And they would ask him questions. And he would appear to be possessed. And they asked him, for example, because the aunt who died was from St. Louis, should we go to St. Louis? And like 20 minutes later, he lifted up his shirt, and it had the words Lewis scratched across his ribs.
Wow.
And oozing in blood. And so he communicated that way. And there was one incident, which was, I found, rather funny, where at one point, when they got to St. Louis, and the priests were trying to cure him,
mm-hmm.
and one of the priests said, well, you know, eventually, I think we'll be able to exorcise the devil. At that point, he'll have to go back to school. And a little while later, he lifts up his shirt, and it's got the words, no school.
Almost like a magician's trick. That's something
else.
When they closed down the wing of the hospital that they were trying to perform this exorcism, they eventually sold off the furniture from that hospital, because the hospital's been shut down now. And I've always been told, Robert, that whoever bought the furniture from that room experienced bizarre episodes and hauntings. Now, what I don't know is, did they manifest it because they knew they had the equipment?
Well, you know, in this case, there's three possibilities. There's a psychiatric condition triggered by stress where people enter a trance state, and they become, if they're close to an animal, they might bark like a dog. If they're devoutly religious, they might take on the a deep voice and claim to be possessed by a demon. And then there's the possibility that Robbie was faking. And then the third possibility is he was actually possessed by the devil. As a scientist, I look at the realm of probability is number one and number two.
It's a remarkable case, though. You got to admit that.
It is a remarkable case. And what's interesting is, in 1999, a Maryland historian named Mark Obsasnik interviewed, he found out the real name of the boy, and he interviewed dozens of people he grew up with, neighbors and classmates. And in the actual case written in the diary, it said that Robbie had this supernatural ability to spit. He could spit with amazing accuracy and distance.
Like a llama.
Yes, exactly. And what was interesting, in the interviews, his friends said in school, he was always spitting, and he had this ability to spit great distances with accuracy. So that's one fascinating part of the case. The other one is things would happen in his presence, like a desk might rise up, something might fly through the air. Some of his other friends said that in high school, he would play tricks on the teacher and make it look like his desk was actually levitating or vibrating, and then claim he wasn't doing it, but then, you know, tell his friends that he really was doing it. So those things make me skeptical that he was actually psychiatrically possessed or actually possessed, and that he may have been faking the possession.
Why do you think, Robert, that the priest never really wanted to do interviews about this?
I don't know. You know, some of these priests, it's an intensely personal case for these people, and it would be speculation on my realm. And what I try to do is just go by the evidence. I don't have any evidence here, and so I simply don't know.
Maybe he was ordered by the church. And the Catholic Church, here's another thing. They've got well over 120 priests who do nothing but try to perform exorcisms. So are they doing this for religious furor? Are they trying to just, you know, keep manifesting that the devil's out there and evil's real and it's a front? Or are they really seriously trying to rid people from these demons?
Well, the interesting thing is, often they're successful. Where in some cases, psychiatrists aren't successful when people go into these possession states. So whether there's a God or not, whether people can be possessed by the devil or not, often they can be successful where psychiatry is not successful. And, you know, you have a lot of these cases in parts of Africa these days of people being possessed, and you go to a witch doctor, a native healer, and they are able to help the person. Now, in some cases, it doesn't work. And there was a really tragic case in New Zealand a few years ago, the Janet Moses case, which has been made into a film recently, where this family had a daughter, and she appeared to be possessed by the devil. And in a nutshell, they kept her awake trying to get the devil out of her for 5 days, and she died. And it was a really tragic case.
That is sad.
If they'd gone to a doctor, gone to a psychiatrist, they probably could have saved her life.
That's a sad story.
It's a tragic story. You know, beliefs have consequences.
Robert Bartholomew with us, our special guest. Where do we get this incredible book, American Hauntings?
You can get it at bookstores throughout America, on Amazon, and it's ABC Clio, Prager, Greenwood Publishing.
Great. All right, stay with us, Robert. We're going to come back at the top of the hour and take phone calls. There's still a few more stories here we want to go through. We're going to talk about one of the famous haunted houses of all time, the Amityville House. We're going to talk about the Amityville Horror. We're going to talk about the Bell Witch. How about Poltergeist? We'll talk about that, too, and so much more on Coast to Coast AM.